Peculiar Reactions with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the 30th episode of Robots. In today's show, we'll be speaking with Richard Jones from the University of Sheffield about a radically new concept of robotics at the nanoscale called soft robots. Instead of the typical electronics, motors, and metal parts used in today's robots, soft robots use molecular motors and chemical energy from their environment.
After listening in, we'd love to know if you think the frontier between robots and living systems will be inexistent in the future. But first, as always, let's hear the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. A giant robot model of the long-favorite robot animation Gundam has been erected in the center of Tokyo, Japan. The model, which is 18 meters high and weighs 35 tons, was part of last weekend's kickoff of the 30th anniversary of Mobile Suit Gundam. The robot is also part of Tokyo's bid for the 2016 Summer Olympics and meant to inspire young people to support Tokyo's 2016 green commitment and to live healthy lifestyles. The icon also illustrates Japan's long-standing fascination with robots and technology. In contrast with these robot celebrations, recent figures have shown that the global economic downturn has hit robotics particularly hard in the country with the world's highest robot-to-human ratio. Shipments of industrial robots in Japan fell 33% in the last quarter of 2008 and 59% in the first quarter of 2009, according to the Japan Robot Association. Analysts expect the industrial robotics market in Japan to shrink by as much as 40% this year, commenting that investment in robots has been the first to go as companies protect their human workers and that many of Japan's robotics projects tend to be too far-fetched and cannot be readily brought to market. Meanwhile, robots which have found their niche, such as unmanned aerial systems and ground bots that can aid warfighters, continue to succeed spectacularly. Staying with unmanned aerial systems, California-based company AeroVironment has received another $2.1 million from U.S. defense agency DARPA to continue work on a small flapping wing flying robot. In a first project, the company has successfully built a small flapping wing robot capable of hovering and flying in all directions under remote control. The new project, expected to last until next summer, will focus on optimizing the aircraft for longer flight endurance, establishing the transition capability from hover to forward flight and back, and reducing its size, weight, and acoustic signature. For more information on Tokyo's new city landmark, Japan's failing robotics market, and AeroVironment's new aerial systems project, visit our forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Richard Jones is professor of physics at the University of Sheffield in the UK. Over the years, he's been looking at why things behave differently at the nanoscale than our familiar human scales, and the resultant fact that nanotechnology is a lot more like biology than conventional engineering. As a result, he's replacing our everyday robotic actuators, sensors, and power sources by macromolecules, self-assembling polymers, and chemical energy. The final result? Soft machines that can potentially navigate inside the human body while functioning in a manner that is somewhat similar to biological systems. As a pioneer in the field, he's even written a book on the subject called Soft Machines, Nanotechnology and Life, and holds a blog on the subject at www.softmachines.org.
Hi Richard, welcome to Robots.
Oh, hello.
Can you please present yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, I'm Richard Jones. I'm fundamentally an experimental physicist, but I've got interested in the question of how we can do engineering on very small scales, really looking at the inspiration of biology to some extent about how to make, well, essentially a nanobot, how to make a nanoscale robot, some device that goes around and does interesting things on those scales.
So a lot of these things, you call them soft machines. What do you mean by soft machines?
Well, soft is kind of a bit of a technical term from the bit of physics I'm involved with. So, at the nanoscale, if we're at the nanoscale in water, you know, for example, if you're trying to do, you know, the classic Fantastic Voyage scenario, sticking a nanoscale submarine into your bloodstream, one of the things that really dominates the nanoscale is Brownian motion, the fact that thermal energies means that things are constantly being shaken around. And so what I call a soft machine is a machine whose interactions are dominated by that Brownian motion, so that things stick, but the energies with which they stick are comparable to the energies with which they that thermal energy provides. So a soft machine has this quality of being mutable, of being being transient and constantly reforming. That's really where this idea of a soft machine comes from. It conveys ideas of mutability, but also ideas of randomness. Things aren't really predictable, and in the way that you know a classical machine with, you know, mechanical moving parts.
Why did you want to go down to this nano level?
Well, it's really, I started my career thinking about what polymer molecules do. You know, the very long molecules that make up plastics on the one hand, but also on the actually the molecules of biology, the proteins and nucleic acids of biology. So I got into the subject of thinking, you know, what do those molecules do? And in doing that, I came to realize that many of the visions that people were presenting for nanoscale robotics, if you like, were based on a misapprehension of what physics looks like on those very small scales. And as I learned more about biology in particular, I realized that there was this whole different set of operating principles that would operate at the nanoscale. So if you wanted to work in that scale, you ask the question, why would you want to work on that scale? Well, for example, you might do it because you wanted to intervene in biology to have a sort of medical device. Then you'd have to learn these whole new design principles that are effective on these scales.
So maybe what are the common misconceptions people have between engineering at the human scale and engineering at the nanoscale?
Well, it's perhaps a bit unfair to call them misconceptions, really. I mean, you know, we have a set of, when we do engineering at the macroscopic scale, we have in our mind, you know, a set of the appropriate approximations to the laws of physics. You know, so just as when you throw a ball, you don't actually know all the laws of physics that are involved in throwing a ball, but somehow intuitively you feel them. When we do engineering, we have a set of intuitions about the way that physics works, about things, the way forces work, the way that rigidity in particular works. And it just turns out that as we get smaller, some of those intuitions fail us. Things are relatively much less rigid. They're much more sticky. The environment of water is very different at small scales. And so really one has to develop a whole new set of intuitions to be able to get anything to work on those scales.
What type of things have you seen in biology which you want to reuse?
Well, essentially, biology is really, you know, you could call biology the nanotechnology that works. If you, as we discover more and more about how cells work, you just see that they're full of fantastically intricate mechanisms. So a cell, for example, it's got tiny motors in it. It's got these little molecular motors that carry things around. They carry materials around. They exert mechanical forces. So, for example, you know, you think of an amoeba moving forward by sticking those pseudopods ahead and kind of flowing into them. That kind of motion on the nanoscale is something that cells do in very remarkable and unexpected ways. Cells also, you know, they have a kind of enclosure. They have a shell, a membrane, and they're able to traffic molecules to and fro, you know, through that membrane. really in very sophisticated ways to be able to do that selectively, so only particular types of molecules get brought in and out. And so those are the sorts of tricks that we've been looking at and thinking, you know, how could we do those in a synthetic system?
So have you made any of these in a synthetic system?
Well, we've made some crude attempts at motors. So we've made they're really toys, really, at this stage. That they're kind of, you can think of them as things like artificial muscles, really. We made something that was a bit like an artificial muscle by coupling a molecule that changed shape with changing chemical environment with a chemical reaction that kind of spontaneously oscillated. So that's one of the sort of toys that we've been able to demonstrate. We've also shown that a kind of propulsion system for a micron scale particle, which operates on a different principle from most things that we think of at the macroscopic scale. So it's, you know, a kind of propulsion system for our nanoscale submarine. So those are things that we've done. Obviously, there are many other groups in the world who've done some very spectacular things too. And I guess thinking of other work that particularly impresses me, I very much like the work using DNA as a structural material, started out by Ned Seaman in New York University using self-assembly to make quite complicated structures. And then Andrew Turberfield at Oxford has done some really lovely things using DNA to make motors, to have molecules that walk along tracks, for example.
Could you give a visual description of what your motor would look like, for example, and how it would move for someone who has no idea what this would be?
These nanoscale motors, they can come in a number of different forms. One form that biology uses is essentially like a molecule that walks along a track. So you imagine a molecule with 2 feet, and it's got 1 foot down, 1 foot stuck down on the track, and it lifts up the other foot, it moves it forward, sticks the other foot down on the track, lifts the back foot up, and, you know, walks along in that way. So that's one visualization of a motor, if you like. Another motor might be just a molecule that expands and contracts, and so it kind of, it's like a piston, if you like, but it's made with a squishy molecule, and that squishy molecule expands and contracts in a cyclic way and does some work in that way.
So how would you control such systems? Is it based on the chemical environment?
Well, that's right. Is that's the interesting and as yet unsolved question. You know, what if you like, would you make the onboard computer on your nanobot? And I think again, one has to look to biology and what's going on in biology. The way that an E. coli, a bacteria, for example, controls, you know, it processes information, it senses the environment, and it responds to that. So, you know, it's able to swim towards food or swim away from a poison. The way it does that is actually by using chemicals to do the computing. You know, it uses protein molecules essentially as logic gates to do quite complicated computations that allow it to, you know, having sensed what's going on in the environment around it, to make a decision about what it's going to do. And I think that's, you know, a fantastically exciting area. I mean, we're just working out how biology does it. It must be possible to do that in a synthetic system, but we're not really very far along the road of working out how to do that yet. But I see that as being the way it will be done, and it's something that's going to be a fascinating research challenge for some years.
I imagine that this chemical environment could even be a communication media for different nanobots, for example.
No, that's right. And again, this is another difference between the nanoscale world and the macroscale world. Relying on molecules to carry messages, they will be transported around by diffusion, which really is a result of the, you know, the random buffeting that results in Brownian motion. Diffusion is a very bad way to carry a message on the macroscopic scale because things diffuse very slowly on large scales, but it's actually really quite a good way of doing it on very small scales. So it's an example of something you'd never think of, trying to control a robot through diffusion of chemical messages on the macroscopic scale, but on the nanoscale it'll probably work. Well, it will work because that, again, how biology does it. You know, cells are constantly talking to each other by sending each other chemical messengers.
One other thing which is really important with robotics is the energy. How will these nanobots get their energy?
Yes, they'll need an external energy source from somewhere, and one can think of that as being chemical energy is one way of doing it. So, you know, you could imagine a system that ran off some kind of fuel, you know, sugar, for example. You could imagine some system of enzymes or catalysts that were able to break down sugar and get the chemical energy for that. That's one way you could do it. You could put in energy from outside, particularly in the form of light, for example. So you could imagine powering your systems by an external light source. So, yeah, energy is important, and various possible ways one could think of doing that.
Can you imagine adding sort of artificial sensors or payload on it, which are more from the human level scale?
What do you mean?
I don't know, like a chemical sensor, which would be engineered and which you would put on one of these sort of artificial motors.
I think you could certainly imagine a chemical sensor, though, again, I suspect it would be on the nanoscale. It's really something that would be able to detect things at the single molecule level. And, you know, nanotechnology is already providing us sensors of that kind that do have single molecule capability. So that's the sort of thing that I'd be imagining you'd have on really nanoscale sensors that were able to detect things at the single molecule level.
I really find it difficult to see a limit sort of between a natural and an artificial system here. Your descriptions for me sound like natural systems, sort of living entities on their own. Do you see a limit, or is this limit being blurred?
Well, I think there's a bit of a there's potentially a bit of a blurring. I mean, why one wants to do this is you know one wants to intervene in biology, if you like. So, I mean, that's if you were to ask the question, you know, why would you want to do this? You'd want to do this, for example, to be able to deliver a drug to a specific site in the body. So, it's essential that you'd be able to intervene in the living system. I don't think that we'd be able to make synthetic systems that actually could be described as living, at least not for a long time. And I think, you know, in principle, I essentially think that biological systems, they're just physical systems, so one would be able to make synthetic analogs. But I think the complexity of real biology is so great that I think it would be hard for us to match that complexity. So I think the synthetic systems, they will have some features in common with biological systems, but I would be surprised if we are able to get anywhere close to the complexity that defines a real living organism, really, not in the future that I can foresee in the next, in my lifetime, as it were.
So for you, these soft machines are robots, basically?
They're robots. They have, they're robots. They will... do some useful things. They will have a certain, you know, they'll have a lot of crudity compared to the biological models that we're trying to copy. So, yeah, they're robots.
Maybe can you give us a bit of a snapshot of where we are now with respect to soft machines and what is still left to be done? What are the challenges?
Well, I think a nice example of what you'd want to do with a soft machine is this example of delivering a drug. So the problem there, you know, you can think of the problem. You want to have some vehicle that you wrap up a payload in. That vehicle, they would be able to negotiate the environment inside the human body, say, be able to, you know, swim through a bloodstream, swim through the vascular system. It would be able to go to somewhere where it was needed. It would react to some signal to be able to and then release the agent. So, for example, an anti-cancer drug, you'd want it to be able to find its way to a tumor and then release the active compound at that tumor. So you can see there's a whole bunch of different things you need in there. You need encapsulation, being able to wrap something up. You need to be able to, perhaps you need to have some motility, you need to be able to detect the environment, you need to be able to respond to the environment by, you know, detecting you're in the right place and then breaking the vessel, the container, if you like, then breaks up at that. thinking further, you might want to be able to do rather more complicated logic, if you like. You'd like to, the system would be able to some extent, do its own diagnosis of what was wrong at that part of the body. So you'd need some kind of chemical logic and sensing system and chemical logic. So that, if you like, that's how you might imagine my example of a nanoscale submarine as a drug delivery device. Now, where we are at the moment is there are systems where drugs are wrapped up in a little packet, if you like. So we've got that kind of enclosure thing under control, at least, and that those systems are already being used in clinical use. All those other things like being able to power these objects, being able to respond to the environment. We've just got some ideas about how to do these in the lab. A few kind of toy systems are being developed in the lab that are, you know, obviously miles away from any kind of use in real situations. So some of the basic functions, we've got an idea about how to put together some of those components, and then some of the more the more distant functions, particularly the logic, the more complicated logic and control. That's we have some idea of how to do it in principle, but we're not really very far along at getting real systems. So that's really how I see the trajectory. In a sense, it's interesting because it means there are already systems that are useful that are being developed for markets right now, and that's really what will propel the field forward, I think.
Is there a market right now for this already, or is it still really only research?
Well, as I say, there's a market for things that are very crude. So, for example, I mean, to give you an example, there's a huge amount of excitement in medical research at the moment about interfering RNAs. These are little short RNA molecules that can turn genes on and off. Very recently discovered, but, you know, terribly powerful as therapeutics. So these molecules, you know, for example, some of the best ways of controlling very difficult to control viruses would come from interfering RNAs. But RNA is a very difficult molecule to introduce into a body. You know, if you just stick bare RNA molecules into a body, they get chomped up very, very quickly. So the kind of excitement of medical research that's coming in that field, that excitement can only be realized if we can have these vehicles to wrap these molecules up in and deliver them to the right place and release them. So that's really that. There are actually some quite strong driving forces for propelling this field forward.
And maybe with respect to a timeline, how long has this field been going on? And maybe when do you see this application, for example, this cancer drug delivery application, become reality?
How long has the field been going on? Yes, I mean, it's really, I mean, it hasn't emerged from nothing. It's the field's emerged from, work in self-assembly and in polymer in the polymer field. It's work in liposomes in the drug delivery field. So it's been going for 10 or 15 years. As I say, there are some very crude examples of these things now appearing on the market in terms of drug delivery systems. You know, you wouldn't really recognize them as having very, very much sophistication, but, you know, they're useful and they're worth having. Everything in the medical world takes a lot longer than you'd like because of the difficulties of proving things work in the very complicated environment of a human being. So one's not going to expect these things to come along and make a big difference in the next year or two, but in the next 10 years, 10 to 15 years, I would say, you'd be expecting significant applications of these things that would really be starting to make a difference.
So you said you have a physics background, and I imagine you're in a very multidisciplinary field. Maybe can you give us an overview of what kind of people you work with?
No, very much so. Yeah, so I come from a physics background, as you say, and I work in a physics department, but everything relies on, I have a very strong collaboration with our chemist colleagues, Tony Ryan's group here in the University of Sheffield. And so they're coming up with new molecules that that we can use as building blocks for these systems. I've got collaborations with theoretical physicists, particularly Raman Golestanian's been a great guy to have around. He developed some of the ideas for propulsion that we use. So he's coming up with an understanding of the very weird environment at the nanoscale. And then I've had to learn a lot of biology, as you can tell. So we've had lots of fun talking to biologists. And then, the next stage is to talk to clinicians, people who are engaged in, actually applying these things in medical applications. And again, here in Sheffield, we've just got a new collaboration going. My colleague Beppe Battaglia, who's been really pushing the drug delivery side of this, he's just got a great new project going with our neuroscientists and people interested in some, very difficult to deal with diseases of the nervous system. So there's it really spans everything from physics and chemistry through biology into medicine. One of my colleagues is also working in the chemical engineering department too. So yes, it's about as interdisciplinary as it can get.
Okay, excellent. So thanks a lot, Richard, for being here with us on Robots.
Thank you.
All this talk about soft robots makes me wonder how close our technology is bringing us towards artificial living systems, and how close these robotic systems will resemble current biological systems driven by chemical reactions. This brings me to our question to you, the listeners. Do you think the frontier between robots and living systems will be inexistent in the future? Let us know on our website at www.robotspodcast.com. And of course, don't forget to stop by the forum for a discussion on today's show and other hot topics in robotics.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Molecular Reactions with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.